back pain may be one of the most common symptoms that patients present to their doctors in this country. Our guest today is Dr. David Hascom. David is a board-certified orthopedic surgeon who will talk about chronic pain and what to do about it on a non-surgical basis and whether or not you should have surgery anyway. David specialized in surgical correction of complex spine problems in the cervical, thoracic, and lumbar spine. He had expertise in adult and pediatric spinal deformities such as scoliosis and kyphosis. A significant part of his practice was devoted to performing surgery on patients who had undergone multiple prior spine surgery. But he quit the surgical part of his practice in 2019 to bring the known solutions for chronic pain into public awareness. He is focusing now his efforts on bringing effective medical treatment for chronic mental and physical pain and back pain, and specifically into mainstream medicine. David, it's nice to have you on the program today.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. Well, medical doctors give medicine. Surgical doctors do surgery. And now you are a trained influence on how to advise patients on their problems for their career. Suffice it to say, surgeons have a profit motivation to do surgery. So I know that a lot of what you have to do is getting the message out.
Right.
And you went from a full-time skilled surgeon doing numerous spinal surgeries to giving up that part of your practice to doing what you do today with respect to chronic pain management on a non-surgical basis.
Right.
Tell us your backstory of how you got from A to Z. I believe that many patients with chronic pain wind up with unnecessary back surgery, and this is the method that you've got now, and it relates also to what you went through. So let us hear your backstory.
Well, what happened, I trained at a very high-level spine fellowship. I left there in 1986. I moved to Seattle, Washington, and I was busy. I was stressed. I was working really hard. I was also one of those surgeons who was extremely aggressive in doing surgery for back pain. I'm one of the few surgeons who's been on both sides of this fence in a big way. But when I hit Seattle, we were doing 9 times the rate of spine surgery per capita as any place in the entire country, and I was part of that movement. In 1993, a paper came out of the state of Washington showing the success rate of a spine fusion for back pain in the Washington workers' comp population was 22% at 2 years, 22%. In fact, you actually cut the return of work rate in half by doing spine surgery. Then other papers kept coming out showing that disc degeneration was normal, yet it was being used as a reason to do surgery. The 2006 paper came out of Stanford that was very well done, which showed, again, a success rate of 25% at 2-year follow-up for back pain. And then we know the research shows that bone spurs, arthritis, disc degeneration, bulging disc, none of these are considered a cause of chronic pain. So in 1993, when that paper came out of the state of Washington, I just quit. I've been in practice for about 8 years, and I thought the success rate was very high, but I was also struggling to get my patients better, but I did a lot of rehab at the time. My success rate was better than that, but it wasn't anywhere close to the 90% that I thought it should be. So I quit, but I didn't know what to do. But about that time, I went into a 13-year tailspin of chronic pain myself. Developed severe anxiety, migraine headaches, my ears were ringing, my feet were burning, I had neck pain, back pain, I couldn't sleep, I developed a major depression, and I couldn't figure it out. And nobody could tell me what happened. I searched the planet trying to figure out what to do, and how this whole process of chronic pain evolved was my own experience in coming out of it about 15 years later.
Are you still there?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, so that puts you in the position that you're in now, which is examining patients and advising them on whether or not they can have, or it would be beneficial to have, spine surgery, number one. And number two, if they have had it, or even if they haven't had it, and they got chronic pain that relates to the back, what to do about it. Is that right?
Right. What evolved, I just wrote a book called Do You Really Need Spine Surgery? And what is based on a grid of four quadrants, and it takes two variables. One of them is the problem in the spine, structural or non-structural. And I define structural as an anatomical abnormality that creates matching symptoms. You have a structural problem. In other words, if you have a bone spur pushing on the fifth nerve root, and there's pain in the pattern of the fifth nerve root down the side of the leg, surgery works probably 90% of the time or more. If you have just back pain, which is not specific, we only know where back pain comes from. Only about 5 to 10% of the time do we actually know where back pain comes from. So you have a non-specific symptom. You don't know what the problem is, and that's a non-structural problem. Somehow there's an urban legend, I'll call it an urban legend, that if everything else has been tried, let's try surgery. But it only makes sense to do a procedure if you can see the problem, right? So the first variable is a problem, something you can see or not see. I call it structural versus non-structural. The second one is the state of your nervous system, that if your nervous system is calm and full of chemicals like oxytocin, dopamine, and serotonin, the drugs that cause you to relax, your whole body functions better, and the surgical results are quite good. The data shown for 60 years that when you're under stress, you're full of adrenaline, cortisol, histamine, cytokines, your system's on high alert, it doubles the nerve connection, you feel the pain more, and when you do surgery in those circumstances, the data shows you actually increase the chance of chronic pain. You don't solve it. The thing I learned about 5 years ago, which blew my mind, is that you've heard of phantom limb pain, of course, and you have a leg that's amputated or an arm that's amputated, and over half the patients still feel the arm or the leg, and they feel the same pain they felt before the amputation. I remember hearing that in medical school, and I'm going, what? I mean, how can this be? Your arm or leg is gone. I've done amputations myself. I'm an orthopedic surgeon. It is pretty intense to take off somebody's limb, then they still have the pain. And so what happens, it turns out that in about 6 to 12 months, that the pain goes from the acute pain center, the nociceptive center, to the emotional center, and the pain center goes quiet. In other words, with back pain, you have the same back pain but a different driver. The current definition of chronic pain is that it is an embedded memory that becomes connected to more and more life experiences, and the memory can't be erased. In other words, it's a brain disease. And so we start doing peripheral procedures on a brain disease, it can't work, and it doesn't work. There's a paper came out about 3 months ago in the Journal of Pain by Dr. Wayne Jonas that showed that in prospective studies, comparing randomized prospective studies of real surgeries with sham procedures, that every procedure done for chronic knee pain and back pain in the presence of chronic pain doesn't work, absolutely ineffective. But it hasn't slowed down the procedures at all. So you have a brain disease, you're doing surgeries on the periphery, the arms and the legs, it doesn't work.
Okay. So, there are plenty of scientific studies about the success rate in back surgery. Now, I don't know whether they're about fusions or about lesser procedures than that. I personally had a lesser procedure, and immediately after the surgery, I didn't have any pain, but developing after that, I did have pain, and it was chronic and fairly severe. So what do you have to say about the different types of back surgery with respect to what the outcome's going to be?
Well, the most successful operation we do is a simple disc incision. We have a ruptured disc. It breaks through the ring, pushes on the nerve, if you take the disc off the nerve root, the sciatica disappears almost every time. It's a very excellent operation. The data is quite clear that people get better faster and more reliably with surgery than without. That being said, people can still heal a disc rupture without surgery, but it takes longer. The second operation, called a laminectomy for spinal stenosis, works quite well for buttocks and leg pain, but the success rate is still only around 65%, which is interesting because those are really clearly tightly pinched nerves. They have matching symptoms, but the success rate is still only about 65%, which for many people is okay. What doesn't work is surgery for back pain. So you have diffuse symptoms, you have bone spurs that have been shown not to be the cause of symptoms, and so it's the fusions for back pain that simply do not work. And in fact, going through the data, last 30 years, the only paper that hints that back surgery might work for back pain is a 2004 paper out of Scandinavia that showed that the success rate for a spine fusion for back pain is about 25%, but if you didn't do surgery, it was only 7%. Since it was statistically different, then the back surgery was okay. This is also funded by spinal instrumentation companies. They did no non-operative care, and that's the only paper that hints that surgery might be successful. The success rate is only about 25% in that paper.
Okay, so let's say a patient has back pain.
Right.
It might be radicular going down the leg, like sciatic back pain or some other type of pain, but he goes to orthopedic surgeon who does spine surgery, and what does he need during that visit with respect to radiological workup or any kind of other workup before someone can say with any degree of certainty that he needs to be operated on?
Well, a couple things. Let me just take leg pain or sciatica out of the picture, because often it's a structural problem that's amenable to surgery. So that's a different discussion. So that could be MRI scans, myelograms, etc. But the symptoms have to match the bone spur exactly for the sciatica to go away. Back pain doesn't go away with surgery. I don't care what the surgery is, whether it's a fusion, laminectomy, discectomy, back pain is not solved by surgery, ever. Now, there's about 22% success rate, which isn't even a good placebo effect. So back pain is a different animal. So with back pain, if you came to me with back pain, you had none of the danger signals like night pain or weight loss, et cetera. There are certain symptoms that indicate things like cancer, tumor, or infection that demands a quick workup. And usually in the office, we can sort that out. But if you came to me with just back pain, we would simply get some x-rays just to double check what's going on. And then we would start the process. So remember, acute pain less than 3 months goes to the pain center. If it's more than 6 to 12 months, it's actually already in the emotional center. And what we found out is that we first of all get to know you. We would never make a decision on the first visit. Second of all, the status of the nervous system is a big deal because when you operate in the presence of a fired-up nervous system, things go poorly. So we work with you to find out who you are, what your living situation is, and it's pretty incredible, probably 80% of the people as chronic have had some major loss, financial loss, job, child, etc. People suffer. And that when you're under stress, again, it changes the body's chemistry. It doubles the nerve conduction. All of a sudden, you have pain where you ordinarily would not have pain. So we work very hard through the process of calming down the nervous system. We work on physical conditioning. We work on sleep. We adjust medications. There's a bunch of steps that we do in my book called Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. And what finally caused me to quit my practice, we watched hundreds and hundreds of patients go to pain-free. And I kept seeing patients come in 3 to 5 per week, having surgeries done on normal spines and doing very, very poorly. So the difference became so great that I just could not watch this anymore. That's why I quit. So I quit at the peak of my career to say, look, chronic pain is solvable, and it is. We don't need to do more research on chronic pain. What we need to do is just implement proven medical treatments, which already exist, but insurance doesn't cover them. So by systematically applying systematic treatments to people's situation, people heal. Back pain disappears. The research shows that only 20% of physicians are comfortable managing chronic pain. Less than 1% enjoy it. I love it. It's the most rewarding part of my practice to take people that have no hope, they've been bounced around the medical system, and usually within 3 to 6 months, we can take almost any patient and help them become pain-free. The other magic about it is it's about 90% self-directed. In other words, you don't need pain clinics, you don't need psychologists. There's just a bunch of simple tools to drop down the body's chemistry. And the essence of healing chronic pain, by the way, is feeling safe. Now, I'm saying that because that's not a psychological term, because when you're safe, your body's full of oxytocin, dopamine, serotonin, the great drugs, and your body functions better. Nerve conduction slows down. The blood supply improves to your bowel and bladder and brain. So lots of things happen when you feel safe. And when you're under stress, the entire body flares up. There's over 30 physical symptoms that occur with sustained levels of stress hormones. I had 17 of these things at the same time, 17. They're all gone. And what happens is that since each organ or respond to the body's chemistry in its own unique way, that's why there's so many different symptoms. All of them are gone. My ears don't ring. I don't have migraine. My feet don't burn. I used to have these skin rashes popping up all over my body. Those are gone. We know under chronic stress out of Scandinavia, a recent paper showed there's a 40% higher chance of an autoimmune disorder under chronic stress. But again, it's not psychological. The sustained levels of this, of stress chemicals, of elevated stress chemicals.
So if a patient had chronic pain, and do you define that as over a certain number of months? Or
right.
How many months would it be to call it chronic pain?
Over six.
Over 6 months.
Right. Okay. I mean, we know for sure it moves to a different part of the brain. It really is a brain disease at that point.
Okay. And what you're saying is that chronic pain is quite often a result of not feeling safe and having extra anxiety. Is that right?
Well, anxiety is simply the sensation generated by elevated stress chemicals. In other words, we treat anxiety psychologically, and it's not. It's just a danger signal. And when you're full of adrenaline, cortisol, and other stress chemicals, you have the sensation of danger. And every living creature has this reaction to survive. Humans have language. We call it anxiety. But just like you're lying on the beach in the sun, you're full of oxytocin, dopamine, and the great drugs, you feel relaxed, which you wouldn't call relaxed a diagnosis, correct?
No.
And same thing with anxiety. When you're threatened, why your body's full of stress chemicals, you feel anxious. So anxiety is not a diagnosis either. So it's just a description of elevated stress chemicals. That's why, for me personally, I went from being a fearless surgeon. I trained at one of the top spine fellowships. I was doing complex surgery. I was fearless. My attitude was bring it on. In one day, I went from being a fearless surgeon to panic attacks. In one day. It made no sense. I treated it psychologically. I went to psychotherapy for 13 solid years to try to solve the problem, and it got worse. Anxiety is a programming problem. It's not psychological. So it's a physiological response to a threat. It simply says danger. It's intended to be so unpleasant to compel you to take action because it's a survival reaction. So what happened with me personally, I kept spiraling down and down and down, with the last seven of them being incredibly miserable, developing what's called a full-blown obsessive-compulsive disorder, which is manifested by horrible, repetitive, intrusive thoughts that you can't escape. And it turns out that a mental threat is processed in the brain the same way as a physical threat. You have the same chemical reaction. The problem that humans have is that you can't escape your thoughts, right? You either suffer with them, suppress them, or mask them. None of those work. So I developed this horrendous set of intrusive thoughts for about 7 years. I was desperate. I was actually suicidal. I'm pretty clear about that in my book. And I didn't know what to do. And I happened to pick up a book called Feeling Good by David Burns. And David Burns was very clear to start these writing exercises. And so I started to write and write and write and write. Within 2 weeks, things started to shift for the first time in 13 years. And by 6 weeks, things were about 70% better, and 6 months later, I was fine. And I've been fine for over 15 years now.
And that was just with the riding exercise?
It was the start. I mean, what really happened is I came across my anger issues, which really manifested in the form of perfectionism. And there's a sequence of anger, circumstance, blame, victim, anger. Being a perfectionist, which is common in medicine and a lot of high-level professions, is that things aren't perfect, ever. So you're always blaming yourself for the situation for being less than perfect, and then you are a victim of less than perfect, then you're always frustrated. In other words, your stress chemicals are always elevated. And what happened, about 6 months into this, I realized that I did have a lot of anger issues. I did not recognize them. It turns out anxiety and anger are the same thing. Because the antidote to anxiety is control. Something creates a threat, and you take action to solve it. When you lose control and you're trapped by pain, finances, circumstances, whatever, your body kicks in more stress chemicals in an effort to regain control, and you become angry. So just like anxiety represents elevated stress chemicals, anger represents even higher levels of stress chemicals. Again, it's physiological, not psychological. As it turned out, being a high-level spine surgeon, lots of stress, I was always agitated, always frustrated. You sort of know how surgeons are, right? Sort of legendary. And you're reactive all the time. And when I came across that part of my journey, recognizing, first of all, I was a victim. I did not know what that word meant. I sort of woke up one day and go, wait a second. And then I started figuring out the sequence of circumstance, blame, victim, anger. And I realized that what had covered up my anxiety was the feeling of power brought on by perfectionism. So remember, anxiety is vulnerable. Anger is powerful. That's why I didn't recognize anxiety. I didn't know what it was. So what happened when I broke through the anger part of it, that's when my physical symptoms started to disappear. Within 6 weeks after I acknowledged and understood the anger, I did not do this well, by the way, I healed, started to heal. And it was remarkable. It was amazing. With my patients now, the dividing line between health and illness is anger.
I was talking with Deepak Chopra. He's a physician of note. And he said, excepting for accidents and some surgical problems, most of the illness in the country is caused by anger. And I didn't know at the time what he was talking about, but as you explain it, it makes a whole lot of sense.
Right. I mean, here's the deal, and I'll just be blunt here. Mainstream medicine has lost its soul. And it's not the individual physicians. I mean, physicians, as you know, work really hard. They're well-intentioned. I was one of those surgeons who was well-intentioned, but I was doing the wrong thing. I was operating people's spines with an operation that didn't work. The data says it didn't work. Right now, the business of medicine has kidnapped us. They will not allow us to talk to our patients. They just won't allow it. Doctors enjoy talking to their patients. That's what prevents burnout. That's what they went into medicine in the first place. We do know statistically maybe 10% of physicians are sociopaths. That's just true with the population in general. But most physicians want to talk to their patients. Ironically, what causes burnout probably the most is not being able to talk to their patients. Because medicine is basically, in a way, boring. We do about 5 or 6 things over and over and over again. What makes medicine infinitely interesting is actually the patient, actually helping that person get better. That's what drives us to do what we do. But what's happened in medicine, I was basically multiple attempts to fire me because I wasn't, quote, productive enough. And the business of medicine is pushing us to do procedures that have been documented not to work. We're pretending to do medicine to the public. And there's also a burnout concept called moral injury, where physicians are watching more and more patients having procedures that don't work. They're not given time to talk to patients. And remember, we talked about that the essence of solving chronic pain is feeling safe. Again, not a psychological concept, but a body chemistry concept. As you optimize your body's chemistry, feel safe, you just function a lot better. A huge part of that is the doctor-patient relationship. And right now, in the history of the world, the doctor-patient relationship is to be considered a haven of safety. That's gone. In fact, it's become predatory. And I have multiple colleagues that have been fired for talking to their patients because they weren't, quote, productive enough. And what happened in the new employment model in medicine is that historically administrators in business was accountable to the physicians. It wasn't perfect by any means, but it was not bad. Now, with medical records and us being hired by the doctors, if we don't do almost exactly what they want us to do, they monitor everything, literally down to the period and keystroke on the computer. They pull us into the office like we're going to the principal, and they dress us down. That's not okay. We didn't go into medicine to do this. And physicians are billing out in droves. About a third of the workforce right now in medicine is over 55 years old, and people are not hanging in there to do this. Now, I didn't quit because of that. I mean, I know about the adversity, et cetera. The reason why I quit is I walked into a patient's room one day, and there's a kid in his 30s who had an operation that he didn't need paralyzed. And I walked back out to the computer to look at the x-rays, and it was a spine I never would have dreamed of doing surgery on. They decided to do a pretty complex operation, paralyzed. And I just remember the moment, I just said, I'm done, I'm not going to do this anymore. And so I quit at the peak of my career. I love my staff. We're doing great work with our own patients. But I was seeing 3 to 5 patients every week that were having surgeries done on normal spines. And then at the same time, we're watching hundreds of patients go to pain-free. And I just remember that moment watching this kid just flat out, prime of his life, paralyzed for something that didn't need to be done. And it's not the first time I've seen that. I mean, I saw one woman who had her spine fused from her neck all the way to her pelvis. She had a completely normal spine. She had some muscular pain after working out in the gym. They fused her from her neck to her pelvis. She was a doctor's wife. And she lost her mind. She went psychotic, developed high-dose narcotics, housebound. She went from being an athletic, normal woman to being housebound and psychotic based on a horrible operation she didn't need. And, again, I saw this stuff every week.
On a kind of a larger look at medicine past what you saw, can you see the same thing is happening in all different subspecialties of medicine because the hospitals are trying to buy the medical practice and tell the doctors what to do?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, okay, my hospital, the hospital lost about $50 million in 2018. And this is actually public data. I'm not giving any secrets here. The top 30 hospital administrators made $58 million. So what's happening, we're pushing up medical prices, we're driving doctors to be, quote, more productive. Since the administrators aren't accountable to insurance companies, really, the board is really just a rubber stamp board, the doctors are accountable to them, they're not accountable to us. They keep hiring each other, they give each other raises, but 30 physicians made a combined total of $58 million. At the same time, they cut down the physical therapy services, the wellness programs, the gift shop, the local inn, 7 out of 9 physical therapy departments. And as a reward for the cutbacks, each one of those administrators get another $100,000 bonus. That's where the money in medicine is going.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do addiction medicine, and I see things a little differently than most doctors see them. For example, when you're talking about anxiety and anger and perfectionism, I see this as one of the sub-classifications of addiction in general.
Right.
The sub-classification I call negative thinking. And I take a approach that's different from conventional medicine, but then my results are so much better than conventional medicine that I know that I'm on the right track. Because if you don't know what the cause of a bunch of symptoms are and you can't define it specifically, then it's very hard to treat it. I know that you
right.
agree with that based on your back surgery, spine surgery type practice. But
right.
it goes to every type of illness. And this illness,
right.
the illness of addiction, can have over 30 different phenotypes, different types of addiction, everything
right.
from the things that you would think about automatically, like drugs, alcohol, and tobacco, to
right.
things that you might never have considered as addictions. Going up that scale, maybe overeating, which is probably the number two addiction in the country, and then the number
right.
one addiction type in the country being screen addiction. People are addicted to their phones, their computers, their video games, like that.
And it is a true addiction. I mean, it's a dopamine surge. You look at it, I mean, it really is a true addiction. But let me ask you a question, and I know I already know the answer, but every person I know that does well with chronic pain, including yourself, talks to their patient. You know your patients, right?
Right.
Okay, so, I mean, I wrote a book that's a framework that allows rich conversations, but talking to patients and helping them feel safe is the essence of the solution. So my patients heal themselves, but they look at the menu of options, they decide what they want to do. Of course, as they take control, that decreases the stress chemicals, but also feeling safe with themselves and with their doctor is really, really key. So I think the essence of healing, by the way, is the doctor-patient relationship, and that whatever form that takes is great. But that's what I'm saying, that medicine, so that's why it's upsetting me right now, because what we call mainstream medicine is not. We're literally pretending to practice medicine, because we're offering procedures that simply don't work. And the business of medicine knows that. So you walk in a doctor's office, you're trusting your doctor to do the right thing. The business of medicine has become quite predatory, as you well know. It's not safe. So if you can't be safe with your doctor, at least have the time to talk to him or her, where do you go? There's no other place to go.
Oh, yeah.
And again, the group of doctors, maybe 20 physicians around the country, and now I'm getting to know you. Maybe more than that. I mean, there's many more that do this than myself. But as far as people who overtly say, look, this is the way to do it, the data is on our side. It's not on their side. We know that mindfulness, relaxation, getting to know people, calming them down, adjusting medications, all those things have been documented to work, but they're not covered by insurance, right? So what happens is that, again, the paper last month in Journal of Pain showed that every intervention that is done in the presence of chronic pain doesn't work, but we still keep doing them. Knee arthroscopy for knee pain, we know that doesn't work. That has not slowed that procedure down. There's an orthopedic surgeon out of Australia, Dr. Ian Harris, who wrote a book called Surgery, the Ultimate Placebo. He's dedicated his career to documenting in cardiac surgery, urology, OB, orthopedics, all the studies that show that these procedures don't work. None of the data has slowed down the use of those procedures. None of it.
The thing about it is, back in the day, before we got into this pain and narcotics problem, I had time in family practice to sit down and discuss the patient's problems with them, and I didn't give them narcotics right off the bat like some doctors are doing today. Well, it's kind of caught up, and people maybe are starting to realize that pain is not a narcotic problem. It's a different type of problem, and you need to have a relationship with your patient other than that 15 minutes that you've got for a certain type of payoff from the insurance company.
Right.
You know, if you try to talk to a patient for 30 minutes, you're going to have to go up a scale on the insurance forms, and that brings in a whole different type of things like you were talking about. If you're working
right.
for a hospital, you do that too much and they fire you. But
right, they do.
It's a basic moral problem to me.
Right.
Is that we went into medicine to help our patients. And they said, first, do no harm.
Right.
It's harmful to patients to say, hi, how you doing today? And then thinking, I've got 5 minutes. Let's get his symptoms, give him a prescription, and get him out of here.
Right.
So.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is what we don't know. I mean, I never made a surgical decision on the first visit, even way before I knew about chronic pain. But what we found out on the second and third visit, we found all sorts of things like their kids committed suicide. They lost their job. Horrible stuff. And just by being with them, let them ride it out, what happens is the body chemistry changes, so the symptoms would disappear. I had over 100 surgical patients the last couple of years of my practice, over 100, we documented this, that had surgical lesions. They had spinal stenosis. They had sciatica and matching leg pain. And I was planning on doing surgery on them, but the data says do rehab first, calm them down, then do the surgery. As we calm these people down for 8 to 12 weeks, they would come in for the final visit just before surgery, their pain was gone. So I'd just like to emphasize again, chronic pain is actually curable now by using a combination of documented effective medical treatments, and the patient takes control. It's solvable, and we're doing billions of dollars of research. And again, it's about the body's chemistry, which is physiological, not structural. It doesn't matter where the pain starts from, whether it's phantom limb pain that you can't even see, or migraine headaches, or back pain. It doesn't matter where the pain starts, becomes a brain disease in about 6 to 12 months. By treating it as a brain disease, it's incredibly solvable. But what you're doing, you're literally rewiring your brain around the prior pain circuits into different set of circuits. And I just had a gentleman who I talked to last week who had 20 years of chronic pain. He had 27 procedures, 27. Six of those were back surgeries. He had high-dose narcotics, alcohol issues, a major suicide attempt, and he is now just fine, which I didn't think was possible, by the way. So I thought it's a certain tipping point where I think you sort of go over the edge and can't come back. He changed the paradigm. He's pain-free, no narcotics, no pain, nothing. He's doing fine. And what happened, he started working with a gentleman down in the Palm Springs area and developed a nice relationship. Use the approach that you and I use of basically listening, talking to him, feeling comfortable. And with support, he started coming off his own narcotics. Then he got a hold of my book, Back in Control, and started finishing the process. And about 2 years ago, he went to pain-free. And I actually talked to him a couple times because I couldn't believe this was possible. He really is just fine. But you literally can rewire your nervous system around any source of pain.
So, in your estimation, it doesn't make any difference what the cause of chronic pain is. Using the protocols that you have in place now, you can get rid of the majority of chronic pain from whatever cause it might be.
Correct. The only factor that seems to determine success versus failure is if people are angry, they're not open to new ideas, and you can't break into these obsessive circuits. In other words, part of the disease, which is anxiety and anger, actually blocks the treatment. So somebody is willing, as one of my patients said, suspend disbelief. Now, you don't have to believe anything. In other words, you don't believe this, that's fine. So you just have to engage it and then let your brain start to heal. Because you can't fix your brain because your attention is on the problem, not the solution. What you do, you engage in practices that stimulate your brain to change. And as your brain changes, you actually are open to more and more ideas and things can happen quickly. The number one factor that determines success versus failure is simply your willingness to engage.
And your program does something called a DOC, D-O-C protocol. Give me the
right.
short explanation of that.
It's called Direct Your Own Care. There's three parts to healing. The first one is understanding the nature of the problem. This is a brain disease. Also, understanding the nature of your problem. Is it surgical? Is it not surgical? Is there a possible tumor or infection that needs to be worked up? So you have to do the workup. So don't cut back on the workups at all. So the first step is awareness. The second step is like fighting a forest fire. You treat every aspect of it at the same time. Turns out that everything works a little bit in chronic pain. Nothing works in isolation. So the variables are sleep, stress, medication management, physical conditioning, and then just life outlook. also the other one that's a big one is family issues. So all those issues have to be addressed simultaneously, which brings up the most important point is the patient has to take charge of their own care. Because there's multiple factors that affect chronic pain. Everybody has a different experience. Each person is obviously infinitely individual. So I can't solve your pain. You have to solve your own. But once you understand the problem and the nature of the solution, you will figure it out. So those are the three steps. On my website called backincontrol.com, there's four stages. But let me just discuss stage one really quickly, that there's five steps. The first one is education, understand the problem. The second one is called expressive writing, where you can't control your thoughts, but you can separate from them. You simply write down your thoughts on a piece of paper, and you instantly tear it up. And what you've done, you've separated from your thoughts. It's just an exercise. It was the one exercise that after 15 solid years of chronic pain caused the shift. So I originally thought it was Dr. Burns' book, Feeling Good, which is a great book, by the way. There's actually the writing exercises, which have been documented in over 1,000 research papers to actually change physical parts of your body. So the data is stunning. It's disturbing, of course, that we were never taught this in medical school residency or fellowship. Never mentioned 1,000 research papers. Contrast that with spine surgery, where there's not one paper that says that it works, not one. The third step is called active meditation, where right now in your chair, just drop your shoulders down and feel the chair. And instead of dealing with racing thoughts, you just simply switch sensory input for 3 to 5 seconds. Anytime you feel a little bit frustrated or whatever, you just simply drop your shoulders, take a deep breath, taste your food, whatever you want to do, just change sensory input. The fourth one is sleep. Sleep is number one. If you're not sleeping, none of this works. Then the fifth one, which is interesting, which came up the last couple of years, is that we're trying to stimulate neuroplasticity. In other words, you have these permanently wired, embedded pain circuits firing away. You're not going to solve them or fix them. They're permanent, just like riding a bicycle. You're trying to rewire around these circuits. And so one way to reinforce them is to discuss your pain. And what happens, people in chronic pain, understandably so, including myself, talk about their pain all the time. They complain about it. They talk to their friends, their family. They never stop talking about it. Then they're always searching for a solution, and I get it. Nobody believes them. They're frustrated. They're trying to validate it. They're trying to find a way out of this hole. But when you talk about your pain, you're actually reinforcing those circuits. So you can think in terms of neuroplasticity, where your brain changes every second. So as you talk about your pain, you reinforce it. If you're in my office today, right now, and say, look, when you walk out the door, you'll never discuss your pain ever again for the rest of your life, except with your doctor. That's it. And since mental pain is actually a bigger problem than physical pain because you can't escape your thoughts, that also means no complaining, no criticism, no giving unasked for advice, because it's not nice. And your brain gets reinforced in a negative direction. And so that not discussing the pain has been equally as powerful as the expressive writing. So just to review, is learning about pain, the expressive writing, the active meditation, sleep, and not discussing your pain. That's the starting point. So we work on that for about 6 or 8 weeks. If people started, it's remarkable how quickly after people start the expressive writing that things start to change. The expressive writing is the only one, I'll use the word mandatory, part of the entire project. The rest of it's your choice. But it's about 90% self-directed. It's better if you have coaches. When I talk to my patients, I'm not counseling them. I'm not a counselor. You don't need counseling. What you need to do is understand the problem and just move on. And so, anyway, there's many layers to it, but it's not very hard. Each layer itself is actually quite simple. But, it's just been incredibly rewarding that not only do people come out of their pain circuits, they actually thrive at a level that they didn't know exist even before they went into chronic pain. Because you're not fighting anxiety anymore. Remember, anxiety is the pain.
Well, David, that's very enlightening, and I think that, you know, this message should be out so that everybody could understand that there is a viable treatment for their chronic pain because so many people have it. Would you be willing to come back again and do another show on it in a little bit deeper detail?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, things I like to talk, excuse me, things I like to discuss are the family issues have been incredible. We found out that We can do all sorts of treatments for chronic pain, but the families are the deepest triggers. So there's a whole discussion just around the family dynamics around chronic pain. We found out that the family dynamics would sabotage our treatments, but conversely, once we involve the whole family in the healing, which wasn't hard, wasn't family counseling, just a set of rules, that people would come out of the pain pathways really, really quickly and very powerfully, and the whole family would bring one of our favorite parts about the process. Also, anger and forgiveness are a big deal. Love to talk about that in some detail. But, yeah, I would love to come back.
Okay, well, we'll do that. We've been talking with David Hanscom, the medical doctor, surgeon, today about one of the big problems in the country, chronic pain and anxiety. And, David, thank you so much for being on the program today, and we'll see you again in a week or two.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.